Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl, mainstream chick of ChickFlix.net.
And this is our final podcast of 2016, therefore it's our respective top 10 list. And it's a little exciting because it's actually around our one-year anniversary of the Cinema Clash. I remember one of our first episodes last year was the top 10.
It's hard to believe it's been a whole year, Charlie.
Feels like about four.
Doesn't it, though? I feel like I've seen about 600 movies in the past 12 months.
And I'll go ahead and give you a you're welcome on that. You've seen so much other stuff and expanded your worldview, I think, because of me, really.
I think so, although we'll see if you end up going to Monster Trucks in a couple of weeks.
I'm not going to Monster Trucks.
Yeah, it's
going
to be a
but
tough call.
But you furnished the wine tonight, and I already guessed wrong on what it was, but I haven't looked at the bottle. What are we having?
We have a Malbec from Australia, but the reason that I picked it for tonight was because it is called Ad Lib, and this is one of those podcasts where we have absolutely no idea where we're going with it, because we don't know each other's respective lists at this point.
So I'm going to Ad Lib my disdain for your top 10.
That's right, but at the same time that you're Ad Libbing your disdain of this of my top 10 list, you'll be enjoying this very smooth 2012 Avant Gardening Malbec from Franklin, Western Australia.
That's weird because, you know, I didn't know Australians could, you know, they produce Shiraz. I didn't know they could produce Malbecs, which come from South America.
Oh, well, you know, there you go. But it's actually pretty good.
All right. I do not know. I know one or two that are on your top 10 because we've talked about it throughout the year. And I remember we did, halfway through this year, we did our top fives. And a lot of those are actually still on my list.
Mine too.
We'll save honorable mentions for the end because I have another about 10 of those. Wow me, Hannah. Destroy my holiday spirit with your number 10 film.
I can't destroy it with my number 10. I'll destroy it with my number 9. But my number 10, I think you'll be okay with because my number 10 is Moonlight. And I chose that one because I just found it to be a very interesting, beautiful film. I think it's a tough sell. I think a lot of folks are just not going to see it because they just hear that it's about, you know, this black kid who's discovering that he's probably gay and he lives in this rough neighborhood of Miami. It's a really tough movie for people to want to go see, but and the fact that it has no star power makes it, I think, deserving of a little extra word of mouth push. And Mahershala Ali, I think, will get a Best Supporting Actor nod, so people should be familiar with why. And so this film just squeezes in there my top 10. And I just think that it deals with issues of race and sexuality and socioeconomic status and drugs without getting overly brutal or heavy-handed. So it made it in there as my number 10.
Moonlight will have star power. Mahershala Ali is already raking in the awards, and he will win Best Supporting Actor of the Year. This is one of the stronger locked categories for the Oscar, I believe.
But I don't think anyone knew who Mahershala Ali was 6 months ago.
He was Remy Danton in House of Cards.
But in terms of movie star power, people who don't have Netflix or who don't watch some of that stuff on television, in terms of a movie star, this is a film that relied on a really strong, not so well-known ensemble cast, and that was what was needed to make this film work. And it is, it's a beautiful movie, but it is a very tough sell.
I really liked Moonlight. It shows up in my honorable mentions. It was very sad, the subject matter. I was just very sad watching it. It has a hopeful ending. It was one of the better endings of the year. It was my vote for Best Ensemble of the Year. Three different characters play the same character at different periods of his life, that is, and it works. Barry Jenkins, I hope we see him again, the director. I really liked it, but I echo what I heard in my screening. Only gay people and critics will love this movie.
Absolutely, and that's probably true. And I Although I'm actually kind of surprised. I thought this might have been one of the rare occasions where it would have made both of our lists.
I'm so very now surprised I'm really it scared. Made your list. This is not your movie. Like,
it's
I'm
not.
Very surprised.
It's not. So, you know, I've learned a lot in the past year from you, Charlie. And so I'm trying to be a little broader in the types of movies that I put on my list. And I put them on there for very different reasons. And so I suspect that some of my honorable mentions will be on your top 10 and vice versa.
My number 10 is a documentary.
Ooh.
I Am Not Your Negro.
Wow.
It is
okay.
Not, it hasn't been released yet. It had its awards runs in New York and LA, and it will be released, I believe, in wide in early February. And I really hope you go see it because I learned a lot. The central character is James Baldwin. He, you know, I guess he's been, I think history has forgotten James Baldwin.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of the name, but only in passing. I've never saw footage of him on television. I never read any of his work. And now you have this whole entire documentary with narrated, voiced over by, with Samuel L. Jackson, who reads the words of an unpublished James Baldwin book. He was writing it before he passed, I believe. And it's about three assassinated men he knew. Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr. And it's so poignant. It's so thought-provoking. A lot of it is video clips of him on, like, the Dick Cavett Show and other shows, and he's telling you about, what do you mean racism is over in America? Have I got news for you? And, you know, do you know why there's racism? Let me tell you why. And he gives these really thoughtful, effective answers. Like, wow, that, you might have, you know, what a, no one can answer why is there racism and why is this and why is that. And he actually kind of answers it in believable answers. And I was floored by this documentary. It came out of nowhere and it became my favorite documentary of 2016. I love this film.
And I liked it a lot, and it's on my honorable mention list. So there you have it. So definitely different things kind of rise to the top for us. But I agree that it's a very good documentary. It definitely makes my top five documentaries of the year. And I too thought it was very interesting. In fact, I thought it was better than The 13th, which is getting a lot of buzz.
They're getting lumped together, yeah. Because 13th by Ava DuVernay, who did Selma, it's streaming on Netflix right now. It won DC Film Critics Best Documentary, and it's about similar issues, not
yeah.
the same.
Right.
There's crossover, and some people prefer 13th. I prefer I Am Not Your Negro.
I did as well.
That's good on you.
Yeah.
And so we're starting strong here.
We're starting strong, but
I know
I'm about to have it come crashing down on you.
I think I have a feeling what this is going to be.
So number 9 is, in fact, a twofer.
Boo.
And I'm sorry. I am justified in some of these ties because of a similarity in genre and theme that I think, rather than have them both take up spots on the top 10, I felt like they could be lumped together. So my number 9 tie is Captain America Civil War.
That was one of mine. Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
Tied with Deadpool.
You wait a minute.
Yes.
Deadpool is so much better than
Civil
War. They
are different. No, they're good, both really good for very different reasons. So you've got Captain America Civil War that just met my expectations. I went into it.
So it's a top 10
hoping,
and just met your expectations.
But my expectations were very
high. So you're going in
high.
Saying it was going to be a top 10 movie.
No, I was going in hoping that it would be fun and good, and it was. And so when a movie actually can pull it off, when you've had so many Avengers movies, so many Captain America, Iron Man, to be able to keep that franchise going and still have an entertaining movie that has really fun characters, but it also was very interesting. It had a really good plot. It was about, and I thought it was timely. It really was about collateral damage when these superheroes are trying to save the world and sort of geopolitical forces coming into play and then governments trying to decide whether or not these superheroes really should be on a moral leash. And so I actually found the story to be really good, as well as it having provided that entertainment factor. And you know, you've got Captain America basically versus Iron Man in this movie, and I love Chris Evans as Captain America. I really love Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man. This is at its core an Avengers movie, and it does a really good job of setting up future installments, whether they're origin stories of these superheroes or additional Avengers movies. And so I just loved it, and I saw it again recently to just make sure that I hadn't, because it was a long time ago. This was early in the year, and it still held up. And so I loved it. I tie it with Deadpool because Deadpool is the anti-superhero movie of the Marvel Universe. It's weird, it's dark, it's twisted, it's quirky, it's funny. It has the best opening credits I've ever seen in a movie with to the tune of Angel of the Morning. And Ryan Reynolds just does a great job. And so it's a dark, twisty comedy Marvel movie. And so the two of them combined make my number 9.
Deadpool made my honorable mention list. What Ryan Reynolds did to the superhero character was just turn it on its head, and it was probably the best comedy all year. I don't remember laughing harder than I did at Deadpool. It was shocking. The action was par for the course. Mm-hmm. It was okay. An X-Man shows up, and then it just kind of derails a little bit. But T.J. Miller as the bartender was funny, mm-hmm. and Ryan Reynolds is just flat out amazing
yeah.
as Deadpool. I found Civil War to be a mundane slog. They try to go for depth, and it's just eye-rolling. Too many characters. Most of them are just filler, Ant-Man, Hawkeye. And they're trying to introduce a new Spider-Man. I wasn't feeling it at all.
Oh, I love the new Spider-Man. I thought he was really cute.
I'll take Doctor Strange over Civil War.
Oh, no. Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah, so I'm with you on I knew the Civil War thing was coming, because I remember how high you were on that movie, but yeah, I'm with you on Deadpool.
Okay. Well, so 50-50.
Number 9.
Yeah,
so you're
number
9. We talked about it recently. It's a foreign film.
Oh, God.
The Brand New Testament.
Oh, okay.
God exists. Wow. He lives in Brussels. And I was talking about it recently with our good friend John Armstrong, and he did not really care for this movie. He says it was college-level ideas, college humor, this sophomoric effort. And I just think it really is a little bit deeper than that.
Absolutely.
You know, everyone on Earth, to get back at her dad, at God has a daughter, she publishes the death dates. So everyone gets a text on their cell phone, you are going to die at such and such second. So what do? Well, the first thing you do is, you don't need God anymore. You know when you're going to die. Some people test the limits of that, Kevin, by jumping off bridges. Some people get really sad and morose. Some people get really happy and go clubbing. And, you know, the people who have short times left become really honest and truthful, and they become who they want to be. A little boy becomes a girl. And God's daughter goes out into the world and starts gathering apostles. And it's just wickedly funny. There's dark humor. One part doesn't quite work, which is Catherine Deneuve and the gorilla, but I still laughed. It's real. I think it's if you can read into this so many levels if you want to. You can keep peeling back the onion, or you can stay on the surface and just chuckle. But it works on so many different levels for me. It was already nominated this year for a Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film way earlier. It didn't get U.S. distribution until very recently. And so I hope people accidentally stumble across this funny, brilliant film.
It is going to require some word of mouth and people stumbling across it and going, I think I heard about that movie. Maybe it was on Cinema Clash. But I did like it. I did not love it as much as you. I know my dad loved it. And so it is very funny. I definitely remember there were moments where I just absolutely laughed out loud. And it was almost because it was so absurd. It's so absurd, it's funny. And some people, if you're like really, really ultra religious, you're just going to be mortified by aspects of this film. And so I liked it. I did not like it enough to put it into my top 10. I don't even think I remembered to put it into my honorable mention. But I do agree. It's worth looking for.
Yeah. It's just so the philosophy of it. You know, God is a dick sometimes. He's just mean, and he, you know, the get in the tub, the phone rings, and when at the end someone else takes over and the world kind of becomes nice, someone could be doing a better job sometimes.
Brilliant. Yeah, it makes you wonder if there was only somebody else pulling the strings once in a while. But that leads me into, though, my number 8, which you actually should probably appreciate on some level, because it's another pair of movies. It's another tie.
Hannah, you're killing
me. Sorry.
Sorry.
It's my last pair, I swear. It's my last tie. But they are two. I consider a British film to be also a foreign film.
Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm.
I know. Technically, no. But because it's in English, heaven forbid, it's a movie that doesn't
have
subtitles.
It's usually foreign language film.
I know. But I consider it's an art house movie. So these two art house movies, but one a lot of folks have not seen yet. And so the tie is between a movie, a British film called I, Daniel Blake, and the Swedish film A Man Called Ove. And so both have the central character being a somewhat, guy in their maybe upper 50s, early 60s. And with I, Daniel Blake, I believe it's like in limited release. It's coming out in limited release right now, but it's going to be hard to find. But if you hear about it, it's worth keeping on your radar. It's about this guy who, he's a skilled carpenter. He has a heart attack. His doctors tell him, you really have to stop working. You cannot work. So he has to then apply for state welfare, and he gets caught in just this ridiculous bureaucratic mess. And it's about this one-man crusade to try and battle through the bureaucracy. And along the way, he meets this single mom. And it's the story. It's very bittersweet. It's so moving. Anybody who's ever had to file any appeals or insurance claims or filed for unemployment or welfare, they're going to really feel an absolute emotional attachment to this movie and to these characters. And so I really, really liked it, and I think it's worth keeping an eye out for. A Man Called Ove, I read the book. It's a foreign film that I think is still my favorite foreign film of the year. And it is, you know, this curmudgeonly guy who basically wants to check out of life. And this pregnant Persian woman moves in next door, and their lives become somewhat intertwined, and he gets sort of a new purpose in life. And it's a very moving film. Anybody who's read the book may want to see this movie. The book is better. The book is still better. I cried during the reading of the book, and I did not necessarily cry as much during the film itself. But it's worth seeing if you've read the book, but it's also worth seeing if you haven't read it. And so I, Daniel Blake, and A Man Called Ove, two movies that are art house movies that made my top 10. And I think are worth seeking out.
I think lumping these together in one number 8 category is kind of cheating. These are different films. A Man Called Ove, it just about made my honorable mention list. It's my third, fourth, or fifth favorite foreign film of the year. It's good. It's Swedish. It's and again, it's got that dark humor to it.
Mm-hmm.
Him and one of he does not get along with his neighbors anymore. At one point, he did, but. You find out in flashbacks why he has soured on life, and it's pretty moving about why. But at one point, he gets into like a car war. He gets a new Saab. His friend gets a new Volvo Saab, Volvo Saab, and then his friend finally gets a BMW, and then like the whole world collapses. That was pretty funny. His relationship with the Persian woman's it moves the plot. It's funny, but it's you could see he's like just a cranky old man getting. You could see, okay, your life's going to get purpose because you've got to start taking care of some kids next door.
You're so cynical, Charlie.
Liked the movie. I did. I really liked the movie, but there are some setup, portions with it that I can quibble with.
But those are some of the things that I liked best about it from a chick flick perspective. So I think they are what makes the movie really more emotionally poignant. And that's what will resonate most with people. And so, sure, sometimes things are contrived, but that's most movies are in some way.
And they don't have a lot in common. They're both from across the pond in like Western Europe. Are you lumping them together?
They're both from across the pond. They're both art house movies. They both have men as the central character, and these single men who are dealing with some major life issues. And so. In my book, the tie-in is justified, and it's my last tie, I promise, of my list.
Number 8, Hail Caesar by the Coen Brothers.
Oh, gosh.
It's so Coen Brothers. A studio fixer played by Josh Brolin. It's like a day in the life of Josh Brolin. And early on, he's in a priest confessional booth, and he's like, how long has it been since your last confession? 27 hours. Because I guess he has to re-up every day, because what he has to do as Capitol Pictures, Capitol Films studio fixer. And in his day, today, George Clooney, his number one star, like Charlton Heston, here filming their latest biblical epic called Hail Caesar, gets kidnapped. And I won't tell you by who. It's very talky about why and how and the what for of his kidnapping. But it's the supporting characters that just tie it all together. Scarlett Johansson as an Esther Williams swimming pool knockoff. Channing Tatum as the, I don't know, who's he?
I don't know, but he was hot.
He's He's not Fred Astaire. He's Gene Kelly.
Gene Kelly.
He's Gene Kelly. Mm-hmm. And his musical number is amazing. Alden Ehrenreich, absolutely, who's going to become a major star next year as young Han Solo, he plays Gene Autry. And imagine Gene Autry in a drama room emotional. Ray Fiennes is his director. He's like, all you have to say is,
if
it were so simple. And they do that for about 2 minutes. Hysterical. This movie... the Coen brothers don't hit all the time. And sometimes when they hit, it's dark. Like, they hit on Fargo. They hit on, you know, Miller's Crossing. But sometimes they hit on comedies like Raising Arizona. And here they hit on a comedy again. The people who love this movie, like me, seriously love this movie. And it's on our top 10 list. Everyone else thinks it's lesser Coens. Or no one says it's the worst Coens, I don't think. No. But it's they say it's lesser or average Coens. And I think there's something here that people just aren't. It requires another watch, I think. They need to see it again.
Well, ironically, I think I liked it better than most other Coen Brothers movies. But I did not love it nearly as much as you, obviously, because I did not put it on my top 10, and I don't think I even thought to make it an honorable mention. However, if I had to pick one awesome musical dance number from the year, more than anything, even possibly even more than what's in my number one, Channing Tatum. And we're not even talking Magic Mike 3 or whatever it was.
And Tilda Swinton plays the twins, gossip columnist.
Yeah.
And she had that excellent supporting role in Doctor Strange. Good year for Tilda Swinton in The Hail Caesar and Doctor Strange. I'm just so happy that the Coen brothers were able to pull something off like this off. There's so many genres stuffed in here. There's film noir where the camera will change into a film noir. Drawing room, it'll change into that. It'll change into whatever it needs to be. And it's a celebration of classic early 50s Hollywood. I felt so happy and alive to be watching this.
It was quirky, though, and you have to really like Coen Brothers' quirk.
I do.
Right. But if you don't, then this movie does not drift up into anyone's top 10 list. Yeah. So, but, you know, I agree. It was quirky, and I would watch it again and fast forward to the Channing Tatum dancing. That's all.
There's
I'll
more
say.
To that movie than Channing Tatum.
If only it were so simple.
Charlie. Oh, that's such a good comeback.
Okay, anyway, what are we on? Number seven here? So my number seven is Manchester by the Sea.
Oh.
And that one is, it's a tough one again. It came out around Thanksgiving. Very hard to watch during the holiday season because it's a relatively somber movie, but it's another one that I would put in that bittersweet category. And I think it's people who want to know why Casey Affleck will be nominated for Best Actor to see this movie, and he will likely win. It's very disappointing. I mean, one of the things that's sort of starting to cloud over his star rising with this movie is allegations of past sexual misconduct, I guess, with coworkers. And so that's very disappointing, but it doesn't change the fact that he delivers, I think, the performance of his career in this movie, playing this Boston janitor who has a tragic past, who goes back to his hometown of Manchester he finds out he's become the legal guardian of his teenage nephew. And he didn't really want that particular job. And so the film then is about the relationship between the uncle and the nephew. And you gradually learn about his past and why he has such a hard time relating to the kid and why he doesn't want this role. And so it's just a very poignant, moving film that also has moments of levity in it because of the cynicism and the sarcasm of the relationship between the Casey Affleck character and his nephew, played by Lucas Hedges, who's also getting, you know, a lot of kudos for his role in this film. Sadly, there's not enough Kyle Chandler in it because Kyle Chandler, it's not a spoiler, he's the brother who kind of dies early on. So you see him a little bit in flashback, but any movie that has more Kyle Chandler would be better. But Manchester by the Sea, very moving story, really good performances. Casey Affleck will likely win, and you have to see this movie in order to understand why.
Manchester by the Sea is one of my stronger honorable mentions.
Oh, man.
I love the editing in this movie. It can't go linear. It has to be told in flashback. If it went from beginning to end by the timeline, you would learn what happened first. And that, I don't think that would work.
No.
I needed to wait until the middle part of the film to find out why Casey Affleck is so estranged from people and his hometown. Why he just has this miserable workaday janitor job in Boston. And once you learn that, I don't cry very much in movies. I really don't. And
I've
this
noticed.
One is, I shed a tear.
Wow.
This is the, and it's the, it wasn't the saddest movie of the year. It was the second saddest. And I believe I did shed a tear when I finally learned what happened and how it was filmed. It's shattering. It is soul shattering. And it will hit home if you are in a certain demographic or point in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly, and I think you understand what I'm saying there.
Yeah.
It's exactly why I shed that tear. There's a scene of the year where he runs into Michelle Williams. And it could have gone a couple ways, and I love the way that it did go.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't overplay it. They didn't underplay it. They played it as it kind of had to go. What a perfect scene. And what I don't like about what's surrounding this movie, it's not about Casey Affleck allegations or whatever. They're talking about how funny at times this movie is. I didn't laugh. I didn't crack a smile in this movie.
Oh, I did. I did. No, I found it wasn't funny, but the...
I did not like his...
In the relationship.
Back and forth with Lucas Hedges.
Oh, see, I love that part.
That bugged me.
Oh, see, that part was one of the things I liked most about it, which is
he's saying, I got two girlfriends, I'm in a band, drive me here, drive me there, and they kind of get at it. And...
Those were not the scenes that I'm talking about, but there were moments where... You should be familiar with the eye roll and the cynical remarks that they make to each other. And it's the struggle that they're going through to figure out what their relationship is now and what it will be moving forward and what it is without the glue of the brother and the father in this film. And no, I absolutely thought that's what saved this movie for me from making me a total emotional wreck were those moments that I thought were funny, but not funny, haha funny, but relatable funny in terms of family dynamic. And that's why I put it on my top 10 is because it was those different layers of drama and humor and sweetness and poignancy and tragedy that all managed to interconnect in a way that just made this a very solid movie. And when you talk about that Michelle Williams scene and how different people watched that scene differently, people felt very different about the ending. And so I was happy. Some people were not happy with how it plays out in the end. I kind of understood how it played out in the end. And so I think that's what also makes a good film is when people are discussing how something played out, how it ends, and whether they like it or don't like it, it made you think about it. So
the ending worked for me. Mm-hmm. It was underplayed. They're at the dinner table, and he's like, hey, we can just make this work. And he's just like, I can't.
Hey, don't give it up. Don't give it up.
He doesn't address it. It's like a one-off sentence. He doesn't address it, and I think that's perfect because he can't even talk about it.
No,
it's
brilliant. I do
what
like
a
the
perfect
ending, but it does make people think, and some people hated the ending, and some people really loved the ending, and some people are in the middle, and I think that's what makes Manchester by the Sea definitely deserve a spot in the middle of my pack here for top 10.
Well, my number 7 is my favorite foreign film of the year from South Korea, The Handmaiden, from Park Chan-wook. I loved his Old Boy. I loved his Stoker. Stoker was in my top 10 of that year, but The Handmaiden is... It's like a con game. Who's conning whom at this moment, and are we sure the version we're watching now, because we go through a couple of versions, is the truth, or is this another lie, or are we viewing it through a different lens? You got to stay on your toes on this movie, because it shifts protagonists, and when it does, you're seeing the action, sometimes the same action you've already seen, through another character's eyes, and it's just so illuminating how it all fits together. I just really liked the story he's spinning here. A con girl gets hired to act as the handmaiden to this very polished, very gentry aristocrat woman, and she's going to make her fall in love with another imposter going, but he's masquerading as a count. So he'll marry the rich girl, lock her up in an insane asylum, take all of her money, and then they'll split the money. But the aristocrat's not as stupid as she's meant to be, and the production design is phenomenal. There's a library in this movie that is one of the best libraries ever cinematically filmed. How the camera zooms around, and she has to perform in that library. I won't tell you what she does, but she has to do certain things. And it's a very eye-opening sexual film at times. Very explicit. And you know what? That's okay. It just works because there are so many different types of relationships swirling around the core. And this movie has a lot of love out there. This is showing up on multiple top 10 lists. It's a lot of people's best foreign films. It won't be nominated for an Oscar because South Korea nominated a different film from their country. People are shocked. How can you not nominate The Handmaiden? What a strong film, Hannah.
Well, full disclosure, I actually have not seen The Handmaiden, so I never got around to seeing that one. Artie Chick reviewed it for chickflix.net, and she did enjoy it as well. But again, I'm mainstream chick, and you know, I draw the line. There's
mainstream
only...
chick had Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea out of her top 10.
Exactly.
And that's not mainstream.
Exactly. But that's just it, is that I tried to broaden my perspective quite a bit. And that one just doesn't, the story.
It would not have been in your top 10.
It doesn't appeal to me. And so there are certain films when you see it and Artie Chick sees it and I read what you guys say about it. There was nothing in those descriptions, as much as you both liked it, there was just nothing to make me feel like I needed to see it before creating my top 10 list. Because I know that when I'm picking if I'm putting a foreign film into my list, it's one that I consider to be mainstream accessible and that might appeal to a broader audience. And so The Handmaiden, from everything that I looked at and that I read about it, it's probably a very good art house film, very good foreign film for people who love foreign films. For people who don't love foreign films, I just don't think that will rise to their consciousness to as one that they would go see.
I was just really happy and excited to go into this because I knew I was about to see another Park Chan-wook film, and I love his movies. I love his movies so much, and I was not, even with those high expectations, I was not disappointed, and in fact, I was so moved. It's just another Park Chan-wook.
So you can have high expectations for a Park Chan-wook movie and be like, oh, it met these high expectations, but I can't have high expectations for Captain America.
No, because Captain America is just garbage compared to this.
No, and that's where we differ. But you'll also probably hate my choice for number six.
Probably.
Because number six is my choice for the top animated movie of the year. And it is Zootopia.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, with all...
You've got to be kidding.
There are a few other decent animated movies that came out. I mean, I liked Finding Dory. I liked Moana. I liked Kubo and the Two Strings is very good. But the more I thought about it, Zootopia was my favorite animated movie at the halftime point of the year. And it remained my animated movie of the year as the year was drawing to a close. It's a feel-good movie that I think works on a level for kids and for adults. It tackles issues of corruption and profiling and redemption, but it's still kid-friendly, and it's motivational. And so you've got this bunny rabbit, Judy Hopps, voiced by Jennifer Goodwin. She's determined to become like the first bunny cop in the modern metropolis of mammals that make up Zootopia. And she ends up joining forces with this fast-talking con artist fox, Nick Wilde, who's voiced by Jason Bateman. And they sort of join forces to crack this missing mammals case that has sort of taken over Zootopia. And I just found it still to be my favorite animated movie of the year. Nothing cracked that. And so I just think that if you're picking a family film that has a really sweet motivational message and some very funny scenes. Like we talked about the DMV scene in this movie where it's run by sluts.
I thought you were talking about very funny scenes. That's not very funny.
Oh, it was hysterical. Everybody I know who saw that film talks about the DMV scene and how there are these sluts that are running the DMV.
How easy is it to make fun of the DMV?
It's easy, but it's also something that everybody gets. It's a joke that you just get, and it's funny. And heaven forbid we go into a film and there's just a scene that makes you laugh out loud because you're like, that is so spot on, been there. And I just loved Zootopia. And I just felt that, you know, you need to throw in at least one family-friendly animated movie into a top 10 list so that people who are looking for the best family-friendly movies to see, don't miss out on one that they really should be seeing. So if you haven't seen Zootopia,
to be reserved.
I think they do. I do think that it's there are plenty of places out there that give you your top 10 list of your of independent movies, your top 10 list of foreign films, your top 10 list of comedies. And so my perspective is that if you're giving a top 10 list for the year and you are not pigeonholed into a particular genre or category, you should try and make that list a balance so that different people like different movies at different times.
So this is a this list is supposed to be Hannah Buchdahl's top 10 list, but it has to have an asterisk. It's actually not. It's Hannah Buchdahl's top 10 list, but with reservations for genre.
Yes, perhaps that. And you know what? I own that. I'm good with that.
I was not angry at Zootopia when I first saw it. I was fine with it. It was okay. Didn't love it. Didn't hate it. I was average on it. And then the orgy of love happened. Everyone showered. This is so amazing. 5 stars. Best anime. And it's like, no. Slow down. And over and over. The love this movie got, that soured me on it. Because it's not that it's not that amazing. It's not. There's nothing special about this film.
Did it ever occur to you that maybe you're in the minority for a reason? that there's a reason everyone else really liked this film, and that just because you didn't, that maybe you're wrong?
Everyone likes this film, the mainstream people, because they were told to love it.
No, see, I disagree. Sing is a movie that everyone was told to love, and people are coming out of that movie.
No, none of the critics
they are
liked
loving it.
None of the critics liked it.
The regular viewer, people who are going to see that movie, the families that are going to see that movie, the adults are primed to love it, the kids are primed to love it. They're all loving it, even though I don't think they should. Zootopia is one that the critics, you know, rightfully liked, and the moviegoers rightfully liked. And so I think, heaven forbid, you have a movie that the critics and your movie-going public actually both like.
It happens all the time.
Well, but
it's
in
called
this
Finding
case,
Dory.
But Finding Dory I liked as well, but I liked Zootopia better.
Yeah. Well, my number 6 is also about a strong female lead, like Judy Hopps. It's Jackie.
I knew it was Jackie.
Natalie Portman as Jacqueline Bouvier Onassis Kennedy.
But just as no Onassis yet in this film.
Nah,
she's just
yet.
Still Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy.
It's so, you know, you think you know Jackie, but you don't, because she's one of the most private females of the 20th century. And Natalie Portman just nails it. That voice, that distinct voice that has a dialect and accent that nobody else, I think, in history has ever had. Jackie's from Long Island, but I can't really describe what her voice sounds like, but I loved listening to it. I could listen to Natalie talk like this all day. It's told a bit in recent flashback. So it's a week after the assassination. She's talking to a reporter, and the movie's not really about the assassination. It's about the beginning of her spinning the legacy. She's creating Camelot on the fly with this reporter. And it's brilliant. Peter Sarsgaard shows up as Bobby. LBJ's administration's moving in, and they're trying to be nice, but you got Jackie saying, I want to do this Washington, D.C.-wide processional, and people are afraid of more assassinations because they don't know who's behind it all. And so Pablo Larraín, just an off-the-wall choice to direct this film, nailed it. I think there's actual real footage woven in. It's hard to tell. It's about loss. It's reflection on legacy. Ah, man, I love this movie.
It made my honorable mention list, so it did not make my top 10. I love Natalie Portman. She will be nominated for Best Actress. She will very likely win Best Actress. So it is one of those ones where if you're going to fill out the Oscar pool, you want to have a sense of why these people are nominated, then it's worth going to see Jackie. If you are a history buff, a political buff, absolutely. If you... you know, there are some people who are absolutely obsessed with Jackie, always have been, and so it's an extra movie to go see a very different side of her than we've seen in a lot of other film portrayals. So I liked Natalie Portman. I liked her performance as Jackie. I did not love this movie. I just found it really draggy in the middle. I just lost interest, and when she was talking, I was intrigued, and I definitely think that that performance elevated the film. I'm not sure if it had been someone else playing Jackie that this movie would be doing nearly as well. But I do think that Natalie Portman does a great job channeling that Jackie that we would, that folks would probably remember seeing in the her White House tour, black and white footage back in the day, and the pillbox hat. And so visually, I like the movie too. The styles, the fashion, it was all very good. I just found the movie in total to be slow.
The way you feel when I say Zootopia is slow and draggy is the way I feel when you say Jackie is draggy. I can't believe it. There's so much forward momentum. And even when she's roaming the White House walls, halls inebriated in her nightgown, just thinking about loss, I was like, this is not draggy. This is phenomenal. We never see events from Jackie's point of view, ever.
You know, I don't disagree that we're seeing something from a fresh perspective, but I did not find it all that engaging. I did find it to be slow. And so, again, I think we just were watching it through a different lens, watching it very differently. And the things that I liked most about it are not necessarily the things you liked most about it. And I would not put it in my top 10, but I definitely made it. I did make it an honorable mention because Natalie Portman is phenomenal in it.
All right, going on.
All right, where are we? Number five. Oh my gosh, we're only at the midway point here. I think you'll like my number five, though, because my number five is another one that's almost more of an art house movie. And it stuck with me. And so it was, I think, on my year-end list. And when I was putting my top 10 together, I'm like, wow, I still like this movie. And it was Eye in the Sky. Yeah. And so I saw Helen Mirren a few weeks ago in Collateral Beauty, which did not get a lot of very good reviews. But she is just, it reminded me just how versatile of an actress she is and how good she is. And so Eye in the Sky was way back when, several months back, towards the beginning of the year. And it's very timely. It's about drone warfare and the notion of different, and talk about watching something from different people's perspectives. You get the perspective of military people. You get the perspective of this pilot played by Aaron Paul, who's really good in it. Politicians, all trying to decide essentially whether the life of one little girl is worth sacrificing to potentially save hundreds, if not thousands, of other lives from a terrorist operation, and whether they will drop this bomb from a drone and kill these terrorists. And it just, I remember just being absolutely engaged in what was happening. And you, nobody's wrong in this film for the most part. And so it's fascinating to just watch these different characters interplay. And it's very moving. And you don't really know what's going to happen. And you're really on the edge of your seat through the whole thing. And it really just makes you think, you know, is drone technology making killing just too easy from afar? And I thought it was thought-provoking. It's also one of the final chances to see Alan Rickman. So he appears for a little bit in this film. And it's one of his last performances. And so Eye in the Sky just stayed with me. And that's why I kind of put it smack there in the middle. It still was on my halftime best of list for the year. And it stays there for the end of the year as well.
What I like most about this pick, and I really did like this film, was that I had to drag you to it, kicking and screaming in a snowstorm. You were so anti going to this movie, and I forced you to see it. And I love that it's so high in the top. It's not even just not in the top 10, it's number 5. It's pretty high.
Yeah.
I didn't love it because I know too much about remotely piloted aircraft for it to make so much sense. But the drama was great. Mm-hmm. I was on that. This is one of those edge-of-your-seat thrillers. I kind of was on the edge of my seat, leaning forward. The tension is and the suspense is paramount. I mean, you could sweat during this movie. It's a very strong film. I'm very happy this is on your list. Good job.
It's hard to believe that thinking back that it was actually snowing that night and we're at the end of the year. So definitely this was one of those ones that came out towards the beginning of the year. And if you haven't seen it or you missed it or you kind of heard about it or thought it might be on DVD or on Netflix, definitely give it a go.
Well, my number five, just like my number six, Jackie, is also another very strong female lead, Krisha. First-time director, Trey Edward Schultz. This is getting breakthrough nominations all over the planet. I'm not the only one that this shows up on the top 10 list.
Who else? Who are these other people?
There's other people that have watched Krisha.
Who are these other people?
And realize that just behind Natalie Portman is Krisha Fairchild in Best Actress Honors. She is trying to reintegrate with her family. There's a lot of questions. Where have you been? You know, you've missed a lot. You've got a lot of work to do reintegrating yourself back into this family. You've missed so much, and to do that, she's offered to cook a large Thanksgiving feast, a Thanksgiving dinner, and she's got a past. It's only talked about a lot, but, you know, she's alcoholism, pills, and it looks like she cannot cope without them. She needs them, but she can't function with them. There's a little catch-22 there, and so she gets caught off guard in the kitchen. She doesn't like certain things. When that happens, she needs to medicate a little bit. She's trying to patch things up with her son, who's not really interested into patching things up, and the ending turns calamitous and just heartbreaking on multiple levels. It's such a low-budget indie film, and you can tell it might have been shot in a long weekend, but it's brilliantly made, and he cast his real family, and they knock it out of the park. Love Krisha.
Yeah, well, this was one of those movies where when you first talked about Krisha, I'd missed it, and I said, since you loved it, I decided I was going to make an effort to watch it before the year-end list was done. And I did. And it doesn't make my year-end list. So I thought it was okay. I think her performance is good. But no one else is going to see this movie, I don't think. And I don't like calamitous. You know, especially...
It's so real.
So is Manchester by the Sea.
And no, that's a different kind of real.
It's a different kind of real. But to me, it was a more relatable real. And a more enjoyable, not enjoyable, but just it worked on so many different levels. This did feel like one of those films that, you know, some college student who managed to get a big chunk of change and a couple of good, really good actors from their drama class to participate in over a long weekend and make this film. So for that, I would put it near the top of my list for, you know, low-budget, weekend-made films that are calamitous in a, you know, in a very sobering sort of way. But I did not have it in my top 10, and I did not have it in my honorable mentions. And I just think that this is one of those ones that will only make the list of the people who like obscure art house films.
I can't believe you said you find Manchester by the Sea more relatable. I can't believe... How is that relatable? That's such a... skewed sense. This is far more relatable. Many families have the one black sheep. How can that be less relatable than what happens in Manchester?
They might be equally relatable in terms of family dynamic, but it is not at all entertaining or enjoyable to watch. Like, there, I didn't finish that movie and go, I need to tell people to go see this film. I saw Manchester by the Sea and thought, there are a lot of people who are going to really enjoy this film. I could not say the same about Krisha.
Number four, Hannah.
Number four is Lion. So,
what?
And I think that one's going to be on a lot of people's top 10
list. I don't think it is
list.
At all. No way.
Oh,
No way.
I think it's going to sneak in there. I think it is the perfect movie for saps like me.
Oh,
who like
there's a key word.
Yes, it's okay. I own saps. And... though admittedly, as we discussed, the first half of that movie is far better than the second, but it's a means to an end. You need the second half to complete the story, and it's powerful and moving, and it's just so hard to believe. It's based on a true story of a five-year-old kid who gets he ends up lost. He boards a passenger train that's out of service and ends up fast-forward shooting down through India over 1,000 miles away from his home. He ends up in Calcutta, speaks a dialect that's different. Nobody understands what he's saying, where he came from, and he's lost. And, you know, the first half of this movie is just gripping, and you're seeing this poor five-year-old lost on the streets of Calcutta, and you just, your heart's breaking for him, and it's tense and it's emotional. And then the second half of the movie, you sort of fast forwarded 25 years, and this kid, Saru, has been adopted by a family, a couple from Australia, from Tasmania, and he uses Google Earth to research where he might have come from and where his hometown was based on landmarks that he remembered as a five-year-old. And so It's just the kid, Sonny Pawar, who plays Saru at the beginning of this movie. He drives this emotional train for sure. I mean, it is just, he packs, his performance just packs a punch. Dev Patel, who's very good, but, you know, I just think his performance was as good as it could be for what that role is in the second half of this film. He picks up the role of Saru as the young adult. And it's just, this is based on a true story. It's based on a book that was written by Saru Briarly, who endured this. He's only like in his 30s now. And so this was a fairly recent event. And everyone who I've sent to this movie has loved it, or at least liked it a lot. So absolutely nobody who's gone to see Lion has not liked it.
That is because the first half of Lion could make anyone's top 10 list. That's how strong it is, watching poor little Sonny Pawar struggle in Calcutta and almost fall into so many traps. And then the second half of Lion is your lifetime Hallmark Hall of Fame melodramatic schlock of him pointing and clicking endlessly on Google Earth to make it seem, yes, I'm spending a lot of hours on Google Earth trying to find my train station. I get it. Move.
It's a means to an end, and you need that.
And it's still number four on your list, and you even though you know what they did to Rooney Mara.
It's number four. Yeah, Rooney Mara is a throwaway. There, she plays Saru's girlfriend, and I've actually found out when Saru Briarly did a Q&A after this film, you find out that they did not stay together. This relationship did not last.
I could see why.
And it's also why I think Hollywood always feels the need to throw in the girlfriend or the relationship, when I'm not so sure that they couldn't have found some other way, unless it was just really part of what triggered his interest in finally trying to really track down his birth family. And it redeems itself in the last 10 minutes of this movie as well. So even though you've got this incredibly powerful first half, this second half that's not as powerful, but you need to explain where it's going, and then the last 10, 15 minutes that just is the conclusion of this story that is so emotional and unbelievable, and yet it's true. And therefore, I put in my top 10, I think there always deserves to be spots near the top.
Now, there's your reservations again.
No, it's not a reservation. I truly believe that the best movies of the year are the movies that a lot of people go and love. And if people are trying to figure out what movie should I go and see, I've got these 10 movies that we're all trying to choose from. Nobody who I've sent to Lion has been disappointed in Lion. I can't say that
about just because
about
it has so
movie.
Much studio money and distribution money behind it does not make it more deserving.
No, I think it's a good, it's such a good movie, and it is, it's so heartwarming, and it's unbelievable that it's this true story.
It was almost such a good movie. You employ your critical
that's
thinking.
That's why it's
cat.
Number four. If it was perfect.
Number four should
be
this
higher.
Amazing, perfect film.
Well, your Creature was number five.
Which
so
was
I'm
an
not
amazing,
even,
perfect film.
So I'm almost
film.
Afraid to find out what your number four is, Charlie.
Number four is La La Land.
Okay.
The movie for the dreamers, starring Ryan Gosling as the pianist, Emma Stone as the actress wannabe. He's stubborn, she's persistent, they drive each other nuts, therefore they're perfect together. And Damien Chazelle directs the hell out of this movie, wrote the movie, Whiplash Man himself. It's really well put together. I just loved looking at it. I didn't love the amazing big production numbers when they're dancing all over the freeway that they shut down. Not my favorite part of the movie. I love the smaller songs, the quieter songs when they're looking over Los Angeles and that little cul-de-sac area or dancing in the planetarium ceiling. That is what I really loved about this film, this little moments that show you Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling are not professionals. They are amateurs learning how to sing and dance. That is a phenomenal idea by Damien Chazelle. He could have hired the best dancer, the best singers on earth, and it actually would have hurt the film. Justin Timberlake would have hurt this film. Yeah, I'm really happy about La La Land, and I choked up. It might be the third most. I remember number two was whatever one that made
Moonlight
me.
Or,
you know, Moonlight.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't
no.
Moonlight. It was
Manchester.
And this is number three. I might have shed half a tear at the end of this one.
It's very good. And what's interesting, though, I love this movie. You know I love this movie. I loved Whiplash. And so Damien Chazelle it's just, to me, become really now all of a sudden one of my favorite directors, because both movies are very different. And, you know, one just seemed very small and this one feels very big. And but I have heard criticism recently. What's interesting is that you didn't like those big production numbers so much. Some people have gone into this movie expecting a movie that's all big production numbers, expecting better voices, better dancers, and not necessarily then appreciating all these other things that Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling bring to the table, because they're not supposed to be the best singers and dancers. But some people have not liked this movie nearly as much for that same, for that very reason, that they're expecting a bigger musical Broadway show kind of treatment. And that's not what you get here. And so I think there's a difference in expectations. This is a rare one where I've seen it four times now. And each time I see different things that I like most about it. And I love the way the different pieces all come together. I actually agree with you. I think having Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling as not the best singers and dancers makes it so much more relatable. And this movie takes a lot of turns that you wouldn't expect and is the total package.
I learned that when La La Land was first greenlit, the stars attached were Miles Teller and Emma Watson.
Ooh. Yeah, you know what? I honestly don't see that working so well.
Not Miles Teller.
No. I mean, Miles Teller was very good in Whiplash, and Emma Watson, I think, is going to be in Mary Poppins, so we'll find out what her singing talent is like. But Emma Stone is just really, really good. I mean, my favorite scene of that movie was the pool party. There's a pool party scene where she makes him, you know, the Ryan Gosling character is considers himself a very serious musician, and she makes him play Iran, I believe, was the song.
Flock of Seagulls.
Flock of Seagulls, and he's just mortified. But to me, those kinds of scenes...
That's your favorite scene?
No, it's one of my favorite scenes. It's one of my favorite scenes, but again, we watch it differently. We see different things. Different things are highlighted for us. But yeah, you know I love that movie.
I do know. I think I'll hear it again.
You probably will. Number three for me is a movie we just recently saw, and it's Hidden Figures. And for many of the same reasons that I like A Lion, I like Hidden Figures. Based on a true story, hands down the feel-good movie of the year. It manages to tell a really good story, but also be pretty funny in spots and entertaining. And it's about three African-American women who helped do the math, basically, to send John Glenn orbiting the Earth during the height of the space race in the early 60s at NASA. And these women were part of what was really a very segregated division of NASA, where they were basically operating as human computers. They were actually called computers. The women were referred to as computers, and they would have to do all the longhand math, double check calculations and things. And the fact that this story had not been told before is what makes it even the most, to me, the story of the year, is how have we gotten decades later that this is the first we're hearing really about these women. And it's based on a book of the same name, and it stars Taraji P. Henson, plays Katherine Johnson, who really was this brilliant mathematician, and Janelle Monáe is in it, and she's somebody who had to battle barriers of race and gender to become an engineer at NASA, and Octavia Spencer is sort of the third of this trio, and she plays this acting supervisor who takes it upon herself to really learn all she can about this newfangled IBM thing that they got at NASA, and that nobody really knew how to operate. And so she figured out a way to make herself and her team of African-American women stay relevant as NASA was moving into the computer age. And so while John Glenn may have been the hero that was familiar to everyone for you know, going into orbit and just getting the ticker tape parades, these women, you just remember, especially in light of John Glenn's recent death, you just are reminded that it took a lot more people behind the scenes to make this happen. And so this story I just loved, and I just think that the reason I put it so close to the top is that it was a story that's long overdue and it was told very well in a very accessible way.
I have nothing against this pick. I liked this movie. It is a feel-good movie. It made me feel good when mm-hmm. it was over, and you see what happened to the characters later on. You see their real pictures. That's always nice when that mm-hmm. happens. I like the performances more than I like the story. Taraji P. Henson, Janelle Monáe, Octavia Spencer are a triangle of very strong performances. What I didn't care for are the overt, a little too hard dramatic setups to make this drama more dramatic than it might have been. I didn't like Mahershala Ali's character. I thought it was preposterous. And
But it's true. His character, actually, that's based on a true story. She went on to marry Katherine Johnson.
I'm sure
married
he
that
was
captain.
The saint that, the best saint who ever lived, which is what the movie tells you he is.
Yeah, no, but he's not a central character in this movie.
No, but the drama that you're pretty sure didn't happen is when they're trying to quicken the movie or make you care, like, oh, they're in danger. No, okay, I see what you're doing there, but, they could just have normal conversations and the movie would still be strong.
See, but it wouldn't be as strong. I think that kind of dramatic license is taken for a reason, and you need that to make the audiences care and to bring them into to lighten it up. And so I think the idea of this film was to really kind of keep the mood a little lighter. It's not one of these heavy-handed films, but it's a really good one for families to go see. That's not an animated movie that actually has some really interesting themes that can open up dialogue in a relatively engaging, entertaining way about race relations and segregation and things that went on in the 50s and the 60s. And so I think it opens up a dialogue in a really positive way that's very family friendly.
Number three, which is being billed as family-friendly, left me as a puddle of sludge. I have never cried so hard at a movie in my entire life, Hannah. Ever.
Really?
A Monster Calls.
Oh.
We haven't talked about this before because it's not out yet. It'll be out in a couple weeks in wide release. I couldn't move. I was an absolutely puddle of teary mud. I couldn't control it. I couldn't stop. The guy, he must be, 11 years old maybe, 12 years old, Lewis McDougall, my choice for best child actor of the year, way over that Lucas Hedges kid from Manchester by the Sea. His mom is sick, and he kind of understands that. She's sick, and she's getting sicker, played by Felicity Jones. So he has to move in with Grandma, who happens to be Sigourney Weaver. And
with a British accent.
He's confused. He's angry. No one's really telling him the truth, but he's not stupid. He's not a kid, but he's not an adult either. And at 12:07, pretty much every night, a monster comes to visit him. It's the really big tree over by the church that he can see from his window. It wakes up, this enormous tree, trundles over his window, making a big ruckus. It's voiced very bass, very baritone, by Liam Neeson. And he says, I'm going to tell you three stories, and then you're going to tell me the fourth. And it's about this kid trying to cope with pretty much the worst thing that could happen to a kid. And it's directed by J.A. Bayona. We've seen him from The Impossible. We've seen him from The Orphanage. The novel and screenplay were written by the same guy, Patrick Ness. This movie kicked me in the gut, threw me around the room, and just left me to die. I couldn't believe how strong this movie was.
Well, what's amazing to me is that I didn't even realize. I saw this movie, I think, well before you did. And it was at a screening with only, I think, six other people. And there were a lot of sniffles among six people. But what was really hard for me was that I came out of that movie and, everybody was teary-eyed. But I was like, I can't send this person to that. There were so many people that I wanted to warn against going to see this movie because I was too afraid that it was just going to be too emotionally hard on them, especially at the holidays. But what's amazing to me looking back now is that it's Felicity Jones. It never really occurred to me that I had seen this chick who was just in Rogue One was the mother in A Monster Calls. And so if anything, I'm just way more impressed now by Felicity Jones' range than I ever would have been before, because it did leave everyone in quite a puddle. But to me, that it left so many people in such a puddle, And I was like, who can watch this? And
everybody can watch this.
I don't know.
Everybody.
It's hard. And it's tough, but people need to be prepared for what they're going into. Because I think it could be really tough for some kids. It can be really tough for some adults.
This would be great for middle schoolers. You know what? It would pull them out of their selfish lives and their social media and remind them, whoa, dude, maybe I want to go give mom and dad a hug.
Well, and a shout out, Liam Neeson plays the monster, sort of this animatronic tree character. And his voice is just so good in this film. And he is a character as well. And I did like it, but I didn't love it because I just found it so hard to watch for different reasons, and I just didn't want to send other people to watch it.
What if you actually think about the film without trying to think of who you would send to it? What did
you
think?
Because I wouldn't put it in my top 10. If it's not something that I think I would go and feel good about sending a lot of people to for various reasons.
It's okay to send people to a sad film. It's okay.
Yeah, but it is a very sad film.
It's bittersweet.
But you do need to warn people that what they're going in for, because it's bittersweet, but it is, it's heart-wrenching in parts.
Thank God I did not see this in the theater. I saw this in my living room.
Yeah.
And I saw it alone because my wife didn't want to watch it.
Good call.
Thank God I was alone. I do not want people to be able to see me that I'm capable of what happened.
But that's just it. I saw it with five, six other people. And you know, you're dabbing your eyes coming out of it. And I do think it's the kind of movie that maybe it is the perfect movie for a Netflix or for watching on a nice size TV at home. Because I do think that it could be one that proves very difficult for people to watch surrounded by a whole lot of other people. And there's nothing that makes you sniffle more and tear up more than when you realize that everyone around you is bawling. And that's what I remember most from this film. And so while I do think it's very emotionally poignant and it's the performances are good, and apparently it's based on a book that's really designed for older kids, which I didn't realize. They're the ones who have read it. So I guess if the kids, anyone who's read the book, or if adults, anyone who's read it, probably can go see it. They're prepared. But I just definitely think it's one that people need to be prepared for the subject matter if they're going into it, and to have plenty of Kleenex handy if they go into it.
This movie will give you the feels.
It's hard. It's a hard watch.
But it's such a good movie. I do not like movies like this.
I would put that one. I would throw it. Now that you mention it, because it isn't out yet, it was sort of not quite in my consciousness quite as much. But I would definitely I would put that into my honorable mentions.
Well, wow me. What's the runner-up best film of the year, Hannah?
I think you'll actually be okay with this one. My runner-up is Hell or High Water.
Whoa! Shocked, Hannah.
And the reason that it's number two is because it's shocking to me as well as to you that I like this movie.
So I remember walking out of this movie and you were not singing its praises.
Oh, I think I was. I was probably still processing the film. But the reason that it made it so high on my list was because thinking back on it, it's not a movie that is my genre. So you want me to sort of not think about my genre and who I would send.
Yeah.
This is one where I appreciate it so much more because it was so unexpected. A modern Western is not the kind of movie that I would expect to go into and like. I did not like No Country for Old Men. So I was in the minority for that. But I like this one, and maybe it's because No Country for Old Men did not have Chris Pine. And this film benefited from having four really solid, I voted it, I remember, for our WAFCA Awards for Best Ensemble, because I liked all four main characters. There was, in addition to Chris Pine, you had Ben Foster, Jeff Bridges, and Gil Birmingham. And so Chris Pine and Ben Foster play brothers who are sort of small-time bank robbers who are trying to save their family land from foreclosure. And you've got these Texas Rangers played by Jeff Bridges and Gil Birmingham on their trail, and it's a cat and mouse sort of story going on there. and the relationships between the brothers, the relationships between the Rangers, the relationships between the Rangers and the brothers. It had a lot of levels, and it was so unexpected, and so it stuck with me. So when I was thinking about my top 10 list, this one got up there because it was such an unexpected film. I liked it way more than I would have ever thought, and I think a lot of people would skip it, not realizing that, you know, they'll think, I don't like Westerns. But this is one where you don't have to like Westerns to actually really like this film.
Yeah, you mentioned the acting and the ensemble, and they're very strong. I think Moonlight had the better ensemble, but the relationships in this film are just very strong. Chris Pine and Ben Foster as brothers, you can identify them very clearly. Chris Pine's the level-headed guy, Ben Foster's the criminal, and the guy who has impulse control issues. Jeff Bridges, my vote for Best Supporting Actor of the Year, he has a very special relationship with his deputy, Gil Birmingham, and he just gives him the riot act, and it's actually these very off-putting racial jokes, but Gil Birmingham gives him the same medicine about being old, on the verge of retirement, and about the rocking chair. Great acting all around. Love the script. This is a fantastic film.
Yeah. So what's your number two, Charlie?
Speaking of fantastic, Captain Fantastic is my number two film of the year. A man, a parent, a father, now a single parent because his wife is in a mentalist institution. He's created his version of paradise. This is how he wants to see it through. And he has his, I guess it's seven kids almost, running through the woods and learning survival skills, how to be their own person, be their own individual. And that includes also intellectualism. Study what you want to study. Back up your opinions. Don't just parrot anything. Tell me why you feel that way, and then I'll respect your views. It's a road trip film. It's an adventure. It's not a spoiler. Mom commits suicide, so they take the family bus, almost like Little Miss Sunshine kind of thing. They take the family
bus. Or the Partridge Family.
to go to the funeral to confront her father, his father-in-law. And yeah, it's almost an Americana adventure because the kids are seeing America for the first time. And they think everyone, there's something wrong. Everyone's sick because everyone's fat. They're like, why is everyone so fat? They've never seen really fat people before. And they can't interact with their cousins because they can't talk video games. And even the five-year-old runs circles intellectually around the high schooler who can't name anything like about the Bill of Rights. And she goes on a diatribe. I'm like on the Sixth Amendment or something. And I just had such an enjoyable time listening to this movie, watching the kids experience America. He tells them to remember your training when they're out there. Cola is poison water. It's fascinating. And you can tell it's not ideal. The oldest son, he's probably about 17, he's about ready to get to go off to college. When he first encounters a girl that he likes, has sexual feelings for, he immediately drops down onto one knee and proposes marriage because he thinks that's what you do. And he has no idea what he's done is just preposterous, ridiculous. And he realizes, whoa, Dad, you know, your paradise has stunted a part of my life in such a significant way. So this is not saying Viggo Mortensen
right.
as the dad is doing everything right.
Right.
It's not saying that.
Yeah, no, it's not a clear-cut, clear-cut distinction there as to whether or not there's one good parenting skill over another, because the in-laws are basically in an uproar that they want those kids back in society to live with them in order to learn how to socialize and get on and to be able to live in the world, in the real world. And so it's about finding that balance between socializing, learning socialization skills and interacting with others and being like an avid reader and philosopher and knowing and having survival skills. So I like this movie. This was on my, this did make my honorable mention, but I certainly, it wasn't one that I would put in my top three. But I did like it, and it is a solid indie that it probably would make for a very good rental, and is probably available now for people to seek out.
Yeah, the cousins say, you know what, your children need to go to school, public school. And the father-in-law says, what you're doing to those kids out there in the woods is child abuse. And why I love this movie so much is at the same time I'm thinking, no, you know what, sending these children to public school would be child abuse. That's how strongly I felt about it. I could never go live in the woods and kill my own deer and be on first name basis with my dinner. I couldn't do it. But I love that there's a guy out there trying something different.
Well, and I think the message of the film is that there's a middle ground to be found, and you need to seek out the middle ground and pull the devices, the electronics away from the kids once in a while, and and take them out for a nature hike.
All right, Hannah.
Okay, it's number not going to be a huge shock because my number one, I know, I've been talking about it for weeks, and it is La La Land. And so you had it on your top 10, so at least we had a good overlap there, and we discussed it a bit. But yeah, I just, again, it took me a second viewing to really decide that this was my number one, but I absolutely felt that it had the total package of elements. Good acting, good story, originality, fun music. It's just well directed. It's just everything kind of came together for me. There's nothing else that's quite like it. And it's different from the likes of a Chicago or a Dreamgirls or a Moulin Rouge because I like the standard musicals as well. So I like those movies. I like that. I like the 50s movies with Gene Kelly and the Fred Astaire flicks, and there's elements of that in here, and Ginger Rogers, but this movie is sort of a little bit of a whole lot of different things, and they managed to make it all connect and work, and I do think that Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling are just, they've got chemistry, they show that in Crazy Stupid Love, and I think it shines through in this film, and I just like it better. I liked it better with the subsequent viewing, and then now I can kind of, it's one of those films that I can see in the future just stopping on and picking it up and wherever they are at in showing this film and relating to it and feeling like, oh, I remember that movie so well. And so it just stuck with me, and I think some people are going into it now with their expectations too high because they've heard so much about it. And it's one of those ones that I think you just have to go in, realize that it doesn't fit any particular standard genre, and go with it and appreciate it for all the different things it brings into the mix.
I did not like those 1950s Gene Kelly films. An American in Paris and Singing in the Rain don't move.
Oh, I love Singing in the Rain. How can you not like Singing in the Rain?
It's easy because you have Danny Kaye singing Make 'em Laugh, and that does not hold up in 2016, by the way. It doesn't work anymore.
You are just a lump of coal.
I'm trying to set up about why La La Land works so well. Mm-hmm. It moves. There's dialogue in it, and people talk to one another, and they have backstories, and they have three dimensions, and they have wants and needs and conflicts. Gene Kelly didn't have those.
They were different.
That's why La La Land succeeds as both a film drama and a musical and comedy at parts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a strong film, Hannah.
It is. And so when you think about all the elements combining into one, it, to me, rose to the top of the list as overall the film to see, and hopefully folks will.
I believe the film to see this year, just talked about
is
Hell or High Water.
Oh.
Hell or High Water is the greatest film this year because of it has such a sense of place. You're in middle of nowhere, Central Texas, and they're robbing banks, and the populace surrounding them are initially sympathetic. We understand why them boys are robbing banks, because you know what? The banks have us over a barrel, too. I hope they win. And then you have they rob the wrong bank, and everybody's armed, and there's a shootout in the streets, and you're like, you know what, I could see that happening in Texas. And they run up to a guy who's like, hey, you have a gun? Of course I have a gun, you know, and you could see the vigilante side of it as well. And we talked about the ensemble, The Cops and Robbers, written by Taylor Sheridan. He wrote Sicario. A lot of people were very high in that film. I was not as high. Directed by David McKenzie, he's back-to-back excellent films now. He did Startup a couple years ago. Love that film. There's just so much I could talk about Hell or High Water all day. I'm shocked it was your number two film of the year.
How proud are you? How proud of me are you that even though you're wrong on 80% of your list, my number two actually is your number one.
And your number one is my number four.
That's,
so we're
pretty
close. That's
pretty amazing. So even though there's pretty dramatic divide on the rest of the list or for major chunks of it, that's pretty impressive. I think that sort of states that if you are looking to go see a movie that is definitely going to, that you're going to like. Obviously, then La La Land and Hell or High Water are the two to put at the top of your list.
Yeah, good on you.
Pretty amazing.
That bodes well for 2017.
Doesn't it, though?
All right, this has been a very long podcast. I want to very quickly rattle off some honorable mentions. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say Fences, insanely good acting. It's just coming out now, so you're going to have to look for it. But it's like watching a play. Denzel Washington, Viola Davis, amazing. Loving, timely, good, quiet, understated performances. You know, good story about, you know, makes you realize you don't want to roll back progress in the Supreme Court with things like interracial marriage. And just a nice movie. Hacksaw Ridge, generally I'm not a war movie buff. And I certainly have my issues with Mel Gibson, who directed this film. But Andrew Garfield's excellent in it. And if you cover your eyes for the really intense, gross battle scenes, you can actually enjoy this film. Miss Sloan, really good political drama with Jessica Chastain as a high-powered lobbyist. Really good. You've got Hunt for the Wilder People was my Captain Fantastic. I love that one. Ricky Baika in the New Zealand foster care system, kid gets adopted or goes to live with some foster parents in the country. The Child Protective Services decides they want to bring him back. A hunt ensues. Really, really just good stuff. Conjuring 2 and 10 Cloverfield Lane are the ones I put in there for that I'm not a horror movie fan, but they were good. It was my favorite horror film and psychological thriller. Those are worth seeking out. The Edge of 17, closest that you'd get to a John Hughes teen angst movie. Nobody's really seen this movie, but I think Hailee Steinfeld is excellent. My two most guilty pleasure movies that are just bizarre. Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping is the one that I would just recommend that anyone who loved watching those old Behind the Music documentaries on VH1 will get a kick out of this one. And Sausage Party, I finally saw, and I liked it despite myself. Raunchy animated film for adults only. Make sure the kids are not in the room. But it is brilliant in its script and in its social and political messages. And so those are the ones that I would just throw out there.
I can't believe you put Pop Star Never Stop, Never Stop.
That's a guilty pleasure one.
I thought it was funny too, but it just didn't seem like your thing. I want to talk about my number 11, if I had a number 11, would be The Lobster. It's such an original film. Colin Farrell, Rachel Weisz, about what happens when you don't have love when you're a certain age as an adult.
Okay.
It's so...
I have not seen that one yet. I've got it sitting out, yeah.
The documentary Camera Person.
Mm-hmm. I like that one.
Leftover edited film footage of a documentary filmmaker. Just poignant. Deadpool, talked about it. Moonlight, talked about it. Patterson.
Oh, yeah.
Adam Driver is a bus driver / poet, and the rest of his life he's actually living is somewhat poetic. Very slow for a certain type of film goer,
yes.
But if you're like me, it's not slow.
I like Adam Driver, but it's a slow movie.
We match on 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Ah.
Love that movie. Manchester by the Sea, we talked about. Desierto. Oh, man, what a strong film, especially now with the president-elect about what's going to happen to the U.S.-Mexican border. And finally, very timely because of George Michael's passing, Keanu with Key and Peele. There's an excellent, excellent scene in there with Keegan-Michael Key talking about how badass George Michael is and about how he made someone named Ridgely disappear. Wham! Made him disappear. And that's a hysterical film.
Yeah, no, I agree. And in light of George Michael's sudden passing, I think that Keanu would be a good one to just sort of as a little homage. And so I agree. But one thing I wanted to point out, because we do have our Twitter account up and running now, is that anyone's welcome to agree or disagree with us on any of these things and, weigh in with their own picks. And so you can follow and tweet us at #TheCinemaClash. Right? There you go.
Well, I'm not worried about it. I know all you're going to agree with me.
I know, no doubt
they're going to agree with me.
I don't think so. Well, actually, John might agree with you.
No, I remember he didn't like the Brand New Testament. Between John and Christian, I'd like to see who they agreed with more.
That's true.
Well, thank you for staying all the way to the end. This is very long, but important. Mm-hmm. One of the, probably the most important podcasts of the year, the best films of 2016. You really can't go wrong with any of these, except for Captain America Civil War, which is just ridiculous to put on your top 10 list.
Same I disagree.
But I think we will continue telling each other how wrong we are in 2017. So happy New Year, everybody.
Absolutely. Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.